Welcome back to Beyond the Headlines here on Reno Public Radio. I'm Dana O'Connor. Public radio fans will recognize my guest's voice. She's a frequent NPR commentator. Mary Sojourner is the author of two novels, Sisters of the Dream and Going Through Ghosts. The short story collection, Delicate, an essay collection, Bone Light, Ruin and Grace in the New Southwest, and also memoirs, Solace, Rituals of Loss and Desire, and She Bets Her Life. Mary is coming to Reno. She'll be at Sundance Books and Music on Thursday and Friday. She'll be reading from her new novel, 29, and also joining us for the Nevada Humanities Salon. Welcome to KUNR, Mary. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Oh, I'm delighted to be talking with you.
Mary, I love the way that you use compelling stories, fascinating characters, to help us connect with place and environment, especially the desert. It's really clear that you love this type of landscape. I'm a desert rat myself, born here in Nevada. Can you describe to us the first time you saw a desert and how that affected you?
Sure. I actually first experienced the desert in 1972 or 1973. And my partner persuaded me to drive across country with him. He had a conference in California, and we crossed the border from New Mexico into Arizona, and I was absolutely panicked. It was that classic response. All I could see was nothing, and in a weird way, it was claustrophobic. and I hated it, and I never ever wanted to go near the desert again. I mean,
wow.
it just filled me with loneliness and a kind of dread. And then in 1982, a friend persuaded me to go across country again, and I said, I don't want to go. There's nothing out there. You know, it's awful. It's hot. It's ugly. There's no colors. And he persuaded me. I came out. He walked me to the edge of the Grand Canyon with my eyes closed. He had me open my eyes, and that was the beginning. That was,
wow.
I knew I had to live out here. I had to be here. And then in 2007, I had the experience, and many of your listeners may have had this, when it just felt as though everything fell apart. Lost a lover, lost my best friends, lost work. The town of Flagstaff, which I had loved so much, became just overrun with extremely wealthy people, and the quality of the town changed. And I was heartbroken. My landlord sold the property with the little cabin that I lived in. And on a whim, I said to a friend, let me come visit you in the Mojave. She lived in outside of 29 Palms. And I went there to do a benefit reading, and I got there, and it was, I'm thinking it was probably winter, it was maybe early January, and I remember sitting outside this little homesteader's cabin, and suddenly that desert and that country just opened up in front of me, and I saw all the beauty, and I wanted to learn everything I possibly could about the Mojave. I saw that the Mojave was this treasure chest, and that you had to work to find the treasures, but that they were there. And if anybody, that first desert trip, if anybody had told me on that first desert trip that desert would work on me, because that's how it feels. It feels like the desert alchemized me. There's a section in 29 where they talk about desert eyes. When you get desert eyes, and you can really see it. It worked on me, and it changed me.
We're talking with Mary Sojourner. She's going to be in Reno on Thursday and Friday at Sundance Bookstore. She'll be reading from her new novel, 29. Now, Mary, the lead character in your novel, Nell Walker, has a similar experience. She loses everything she thought was important in life, heads for the Mojave Desert, where things really become intriguing. Impossible love affair, problems with the environment, problems with folks coming in and trying to destroy the environment. It sounds really similar to your story.
You know, when I began writing 29, I set myself the task of writing a female protagonist, a woman protagonist, who wasn't like me. So Nell is a high-powered, big pharmaceutical, global pharmaceutical company marketing director. She cares very much about nice things. She owns a little house in West Hollywood, and I thought she was as far removed from me as she possibly could be. And then as I began to follow the book, because that's how it works for me, I start writing, and the next thing I know, stories are coming, and the story is weaving. She became more and more like me, so it makes a lot of sense that the themes would be similar to the themes in my life. And actually, Nell's story was a version of mine. I think that Nell's story will resonate for many, many, many women, especially the fact that she is fired from her job when she's 55. I think there are connections between her age and what happens to her originally that many women are going to understand. I know three women right now in their mid-50s, intelligent, college-educated, competent, great job skills, who made the decision to leave what they were working at and try to do something and go to do something different. And they've all three of them have been unemployed for about 6 or 7 months, and they're not finding anything. And, you know, I was talking with, I teach a writing circle here, and also just did a gig in Silver City. I've been talking about that phenomenon, and it would have been probably around 1990, 91, 92, when a number of women, often in their mid-40s, it was a fairly common phenomenon, would decide they were going to reinvent their lives. And then, of course, they'd move to Santa Fe, but you know, they were going to reinvent their lives and were able to do it. And I think right now that option is not so available to women.
Why not now? What happened?
The economy, I think. Mm-hmm. I think the economy, and I think, so what did I say, 1990, I would say 91, 92, 93. That was when Terry Tempest Williams was doing a lot of writing. I had a bunch of stuff out there. Gretel Ehrlich had a bunch of stuff out there. So there were all these stories about women who came west or women who were already in the west and went from stressful, you know, not in my case corporate, but high-pressure lives and came and, you know, lived in a little barn off a ranch house or something like that and were having a different kind of life and were more focused on the outdoors and more focused on nature. And I think economically now, that's almost impossible to do. It was relatively easy to do. You know, I left Rochester, New York. I had been a feminist women's counselor and a kind of under-the-radar one, kind of a radical one, and moved to Flagstaff, Arizona, and started baking in a little coffee house, living in a little place with a wood stove and no indoor plumbing, and I was paying $150 a month rent. And I was able to, I was 45, 46, and I was able to put together a very different kind of life. And, you know, that's the life that informs everything I write. But now, if you tried to rent a little place, it's going to end up costing you a hell of a lot more money than it did then. And it's also just not the climate, the literary climate, it's not open to that. It's not receptive to that. You know, and consider the contrast. Elizabeth Gilbert gets an advance from her publisher and trundles off around the world and writes Eat, Pray, Love. That's a very different kind of concept. So that's just my take on it. I think it's the economy, and I think people are just very fearful of walking away from jobs where there's health insurance.
Yes.
So it's just a different time. It's a much more constricted time.
Well, my next question was, since that option is no longer available, what can a woman in her mid-50s who wants to change, can't afford to change, is stuck in a job that maybe she's not totally suited for, but wants to do, say, what your character Nell Walker in the book 29 does, to get out, to go somewhere else, to start over, to reinvent herself? Is there a way that we can do that with this economy right now?
Oh, my gosh. There are as many different longings to do that as there are different women. So we're talking about different socioeconomic classes, different ethnicities. I don't think there's a way to answer that for every woman. I believe that there are variations on the reinventing yourself that a woman in her mid-50s could practice. And often what it means letting go of degrees of security and safety. It means living on much less money than one might be used to, or for those of us who live, you know, at low income levels, I'm not sure what it would mean.
My guest is Mary Sojourner. She's the author of a new book, 29, published by Torrey House Press, and she'll be here in Reno on Thursday the 16th at 6:30 p.m. for a reading and book signing at Sundance Bookstore. And then on Friday at 6 p.m., Mary Sojourner is the special guest for our Nevada Humanities October Salon in conversation with Mary Sojourner. That's at 6 p.m. on Friday at Sundance at 121 California Avenue. Mary, I love the mystical elements of the book 29. In the opening, when Nell is dreaming of the bees leaving, that's such a beautiful passage right there.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Should I read that?
Yes, please.
The hives burned gold in the last wash of desert sunset. A quarter moon moved up into the darkening sky. The lights of a desert city, a dirty smudge above the eastern range. An agreement was reached. It was time to go. One by one, the bees ascended, as though a coil of smoke rose from the hives. Bee by bee, the spiral thickened, swirled across the moon and was gone. The hum faded. Deep within the hive, the queen waited alone.
I love that opening scene. I just think that one by one, bees curling up like smoke, just gorgeous. And the fact that it was a dream that spurred Nell into leap into action and sever everything and take off, that's even more intriguing to me.
You know, there's two or three themes that weave through the book about loss and potential loss. And one is the bees. And the second is there's a creature called a leafy sea dragon that lives off the southwest coast of Australia. And it's an exquisite creature. It there's a description of it in the book, but it essentially looks like a seahorse, a pink and silver seahorse with fronds of kelp coming off of it, but they're actual body parts. And that creature is in danger. And then once Nell gets to 29, she learns that the Chemehuevi people of that area are in peril of losing their most sacred practice, which is the salt songs. And the salt songs represent a trail that the Chemehuevi have used for beyond time to gather salt, to hunt, to explore. It's a huge trail. It actually goes from southwest Arizona up to Vegas, then up to Utah, and then over to Vegas, and then comes back through 29 Palms. And there are 142 songs representing places on this trail. It's also a spiritual trail. It's the path that the soul takes after the moment of death so that the soul can go forward. And when a Chemehuevi person dies, a traditional Chemehuevi person or maybe not traditional, the people who know the songs get together for a whole night and sing the songs so the soul can find its way. And what occurs is they discover that a huge corporate solar power installation is threatened to go in, and that solar power installation would compromise some sacred places on the trail. So they're the bees, the leafy sea dragons, the web of life, and the trail. And for the Chemehuevi, if that trail is damaged, there'll be damage that will spread out not just from their culture but throughout the world. That's a very common indigenous belief, that if damage is done to my backyard, it affects everything.
Which is a difficult concept, I think, for a lot of people, particularly business interests, to understand.
Yes, that's an understatement. I think as often in the case of profit margins, there's the terror that if there's the slightest loss in a profit margin, then everything's going to fall apart. That's a whole complex based on fear and based on the fantasy that if you have enough money, you're safe. And of course, for many, many wealthy people, who can say what's enough money? You know, that's chilling. For me, it's the losses for me, and that's what's driven me from the time I was a little girl, because I grew up in a difficult childhood, and I escaped to the outdoors, and was in Irondequoit, which is a little town on the edge of Lake Ontario, and Xerox and Kodak came in, and I used to escape out into the woodlands and little streams and hills, and those were the days when a little girl could take off with a sandwich and an apple in her pocket and alone and explore. And when these big corporations came in, they built suburbs. Suburbs were built, and if I went back there now, I wouldn't recognize the places that gave me so much solace.
It's all gone.
Yep, gone.
And when did you decide that writing would be a way for you to heal from these losses?
Well, I didn't. I mean, I didn't consciously do that. As a child, as I said, outdoors was shelter, and reading was shelter. And we had a tiny little library. I lived in a little bitty farm town, and we had a little library underneath the bank. And no matter how scary it was at home, I could go to the library, and then the wonderful library ladies were there. And it was cool and peaceful, and I could read, and I just read and read and read. To this day, if I don't have a good novel or a good collection of short stories or good natural history to read at night before I go to sleep, I can't go to sleep.
Now, Mary, we've been talking about the possibilities of healing through writing, healing through landscapes, and you've often written about the limitations of healing through writing. What are those limitations?
Well, I think as our society speeds up faster and faster and faster, and the pressure and demands on us are intensified, I have friends who are on faculty at colleges and universities, and they are running as fast as they can, and they can't keep up. And that has to do with budget cuts, and that has to do with colleges and universities being run as businesses at this point. So I see this hideous speeding up. And I said earlier that I teach young people, and one of the first things I ask them when I'm doing a writing circle with them is, how many of you feel that you're under just exhausting pressure? How many of you would rather put your heads down on the desk and sleep? And inevitably, 80% of the class put their hand up. They're just driven. I have a grandson who's just driven, and he's a high school student. And having said that, I don't know how to write a way into personal sanity when one is living in an insane society. I think one can write into temporary comfort. One can write into a temporary sense of ease. But, you know, I am so fortunate. I get to teach for a living, freelance teach for a living, and I make a little bit of money from writing. You know, that's a fantasy that you can earn your living from writing. So I'm not under the kind of pressure many of my friends are. And it's no surprise to me when I'm teaching writing circles and my students say, can you just tell me how to get the time to write? Because of this bizarre set of pressures and demands that are on us. And I have to say, particularly women in my experience, I think if a woman is balancing partnership, raising children, work, when is she going to find the time to sit down with a pen and a journal and come to the kind of healing I'm talking about?
And how productive would that time be with all those pressures?
Exactly. One of the most poignant moments I ever had is I was teaching, and this was ages ago. This probably 15 years ago. I was teaching at ASU in Tempe in a writing conference, and we'd done a writing from place workshop because I write from place. It's place that informs me. It's place that moves the pen, really, moves my hands on the keyboard. And we got finished up, and there was a very, you know, beautifully pulled together, beautifully groomed, great haircut woman, and she had tears running down her face, and she said, "I just have one question. How can you tell me, how can I find 15 minutes each day to write?" And there was like dead silence. There were 85 students in the room, the dead silence, and I took a deep breath, and I try to be as honest as I can be, and I just said, "I don't know." And she slumped against the wall, and she said, "I knew you were going to say that." And she said, "Thank you." And then I talked a little bit about the ways we sabotage writing. Sometimes we choose certain ways to be busy. But then I said to the group, "How many of you feel the same way?" And almost every single hand went up. And that was 15 years ago.
Tell me more about the ways we sabotage writing.
While writing can feel healing, writing can also feel terrifying to people. And I think that makes sense because healing can feel terrifying to people. Change can feel terrifying to people. When you have change, you have loss. There's no way to change without some loss. And so I've known everything of my students, I think of myself. They can decide they're going to write. They're going to finally write the book that they've been wanting to write, or the short story, or the article, and then get involved with a very high-maintenance partner, or decide to have kids. Or it can be more subtle. It can be more unconscious. You can get sick. You know, you can suddenly find yourself not feeling well. The most common thing that happens is you suddenly have to get up and sharpen all the pencils on your desk, or you have to wash all the dishes when, in fact, you hate housekeeping. That's a real common way I see women do it.
Does that happen to you? Are you able to focus and write without distractions?
Well, sometimes. She squeaked. Sometimes. I don't control my writing, so I'm kind of at the service of my writing, so the best I can do sometimes is to keep my life at a certain kind of disordered order so that the writing can come through. I reworked 29. It started out as a different book. I wrote it in 3 months as a kind of exorcism of the relationship that had not worked out. And last year I had to gut about two-thirds of it and then write three-quarters more. And it was just coming. It would just come. And at this point, I'm writing on the computer. And I'd write on the computer, and then I'd go out to get groceries or something, and something would come to me, and I'd make notes on a little notebook that I keep in the car. And when it's really cooking like that, I don't sabotage it. Other times, I'll just keep myself in a tizzy about something, or decide I know what a friend needs to do about the problems in their life, and I'll get really caught up in that. So, oh yeah, you bet, you bet.
It sounds like you need time and space to let this, I won't say it's a mystical process, but just to let the process of the writing come out, something that I think, as you said before, a lot of people in this day and era, they don't have the time, they don't have the space.
No, they don't have the mental space. They don't have the inner space. And, you know, I talked about going outdoors. I'm lucky I live in Flagstaff, and there are trails within. There's a beautiful big wetland within 5 minutes from the place that I live. And I live in a little single-wide, you know, trailer manufactured home. And the gift is it's right near this wetland and near forest. And so I can get out where I feel whole. Sometimes I have to make myself do that. I get hooked on the internet because that is such an addictive, whatever it is, entity for me.
Yes.
But, you know, what I'll say to students is that as you are in relation to your life, that's how you are in relation to your writing. So if you're keeping your life crammed up and jammed up when you have choices to ease off on yourself, then you're going to be the same way with your writing, and it's going to feel like a chore. But I must say, when there's room and that flow starts to come through, it's one of the most amazing feelings I know.
Mary, you said before that you believe in both the limitations and possibilities of healing through writing.
Yes.
Can you suggest ways for people to heal through writing? What can we do? How can we cope? Are there any coping skills for us right now in terms of writing?
That's a great question. I think, you know, I hope at the reading that people bring up questions like this, because I would like to go face-to-face talking about it. I believe that writing, particularly writing by hand, is inherently healing. You know, I had mentioned that my degree was in psychology a long time ago, and part of the degree was in physiological psychology. And there's something about the actual physical, neurological connections between the hand and the brain in the process of writing that I think has healing effects. And so in my 30s, I started keeping journals. And I was thinking about this last night. I was teaching my writing circle, and we were free writing. So that just means you take a theme and you write on it. And I was writing, and I wrote about writing. And writing, keeping a journal, was my first real experience of being filled with feelings about something, sorrow, joy, whatever. And writing and feeling the intensity of the emotion, it's almost as though the emotion was coming out through my hand into the pen onto the paper. And so if it was a joyful moment, it actually ended up being a record of the joyful moment. And if there was sorrow, it would somehow soften the sorrow. It would, the writing of it could help me find my way through the kind of anger where you feel helpless, to a way to be with the anger and maybe to use the anger for action.
Mary Sojourner will be in Reno on Thursday at 6:30 p.m. reading and signing her book, 29. And she's hanging around on Friday for Nevada Humanities October Salon in conversation with Mary Sojourner. That event is open to the public as well, 6 p.m. Friday, October 17th. It's all happening at Sundance Books and Music at 121 California Avenue. Mary, it's a pleasure to have this conversation with you. Thank you so much for all of your wonderful books, and thanks for coming back to Nevada. We missed you.
Thank you, Dana. I've missed Nevada, and I have to say that this interview, I'm putting quotes around it, was more like a conversation between friends. It was wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, and I'm really looking forward to meeting you.
Me too.